The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Siegel, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Luis Dovre Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, May 26, 2021. We are proceeding by Zoom this morning, but otherwise our proceedings are the same as they would be in the courtroom. And I welcome you all here for the first case, which is consolidated appeals in the matter of the decision on the need for an environmental impact statement for the proposed Barrick Family Farms. I understand counsel for respondents will be splitting their time equally. Is that correct? I'm seeing nodding, so that's good. And so we will begin then with counsel for relator. Just a reminder to everyone, it's important that you keep yourself muted when you are not speaking. Counsel for relator, you will have the full 15 minutes to make your argument and will also have an opportunity for rebuttal if you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments. And with that, counsel for relator, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Joy Anderson, and I am here today representing the relator, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Your Honor, we are here today challenging the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's decision to end environmental review for a feedlot that is proposed by Barrick Farms that would have 16,000 hogs and would use 15 million gallons of water each year. MPCA decided that this feedlot did not require a more detailed environmental impact statement, even though the environmental assessment worksheet for this feedlot did not include an assessment of water resources available for appropriation as specifically required by the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, or MEPA. And even though MPCA did not know whether the feedlot's well would affect the local aquifer, neighboring wells, or the nearby calcareous fens, and even though MPCA itself recognized that it needed this information to decide whether an EIS was needed. But after Barrick threatened to sue, it then changed its mind and ended environmental review.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Anderson, I mean, as I read 116D.04, I don't see that the MPCA had the authority to extend the comment period another 30 days, given the fact that there was no agreement by the proposer?
Your Honor, they had a choice then. So that is the necessary information rule. Okay, it's 4410.1700, subpart 2A. And that says that if there is information that can be obtained that is needed to determine whether an EIS is needed, and you can get that information, you have two choices. Either you can extend the time for the EIS decision in order to get that information, or you can order an EIS. So MPCA had choices when it determined that the aquifer test was not going to be available in time. If it couldn't extend the time for the EIS decision, it had to order an EIS. That's what the rule says it has to do.
So another question, with the DNR having issued the permit, and I know that this panel needs to decide whether to take judicial notice of that or not, and that's a contested issue. And we were to remand. Is there anything more to be done? I mean, is it kind of futile at this point? Because if an EIS had been ordered, I mean, could the scope be narrow enough to, it seems like the only issue is the impact on domestic wells and, I'm not sure I'm saying this right, but calcareous fens, is that the proper pronunciation?
Your Honor, I believe it's calcareous.
Calcareous. Thank you so much. Calcareous.
I've learned so much about them lately.
Yeah, no, I was actually up north over the winter and we saw some fens up there in the fall. So back to my question, is there anything else to be done? Is it kind of futile? Are we arguing about not much of anything at this point? I mean,
yes, absolutely. It is not futile. It's really important. So if you allow the situation to happen like it did, if MPCA is allowed to do the environmental review and the environmental review, make the decisions about its permit, and then gather information about the environmental effects later, that completely eviscerates the purpose of MEPA and the way that environmental review is supposed to work. If we are allowed to go back and reopen environmental review, Relator and other members of the public will have an opportunity to comment on the aquifer test. And MPCA will have to look at and respond to those comments. And we are also asking for the feedlot permit that MPCA granted to be reversed and remanded. MPCA has the ability through that feedlot permit, through the ability to order an EIS, to demand design changes in the feedlot. If we do this correctly, MPCA can say, look, it looks like there's gonna be a problem with water. We can redesign the feedlot to use less water. We can redesign it for recapturing water. There's a lot of different things that we can do to the design of the feedlot that can address the environmental effects. But if you do that later, if you do the environmental review first, end it, then get the information, at that point, there's not anything MPCA can do. So we need to go back, do this properly, look at what the actual effects that the well will have, and then decide how do we proceed from here.
Hey, Ms. Anderson, taking the information that was available to the MPCA at the time, so stepping back and sort of ignoring what happened ultimately with the aquifer testing and the well permit. I mean, as I read MEPA, I mean, it clearly says, or at least it's clear to me, that the MEPA process is not supposed to duplicate other environmental review. And what the DNR is doing through its permitting process and the aquifer testing in particular, I mean, that's environmental review, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is environmental review. And yes, so subdivision 15 in Minnesota statute 116D.04, subdivision 15, does say that you are not supposed to duplicate environmental review when that's possible.
But, and isn't that really what you were asking to do here? I mean, I don't know what the, I mean, water appropriation, as I understand it, is the issue with respect to this case. I mean, I don't think there's any other respects in which an EIS, you're arguing a EIS was required. But if in fact the water appropriation evaluation is being done in another process, I don't understand why we would fault the MPCA for declining to order the EIS on that sole issue.
Well, so looking at subdivision 15, it specifically says that you can avoid this duplication, but only so as not to conflict with other requirements of this section. So subdivision 16 is obviously another requirement of that section. And it says you've got to have an assessment of the water resources available for appropriation in that environmental assessment worksheet. So if subdivision 15 says, look, you don't have to duplicate if it's not necessary, but subdivision 16 says, you've got to have this information in the EAW, subdivision 16 trumps that. And importantly, yes?
Sorry, so Ms. Anderson, so where in subdivision 16 does it require an aquifer test?
It does not, Your Honor. We are not saying that in all instances this would have to be an aquifer test. Subdivision 16 requires an assessment of the water resources available for appropriation. And we can talk about what those phrases exactly mean. In this case, it made sense to have this, to have that assessment be an aquifer test because, number one, DNR said, this is what we need to determine the effects of this well. We need to have an aquifer test. We don't know otherwise what this well is going to do. Number right, two, so it was in progress. It was in process. It was being done. If we would have waited, if MPCA would have waited 2 more months for the aquifer test to be done, this whole appeal might have been unnecessary. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, that's okay. But isn't it really the DNR's jurisdiction to determine whether or not an aquifer test is required?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. They can determine whether an aquifer test is required. But what they can't do is prevent an assessment of the water resources available for appropriation being included in the EAW. So, and it's completely possible for an aquifer test to be included in the EAW. I've seen multiple other CAFOs where they include it. So this does happen.
It can happen, but what if the DNR says we don't we don't require it to be part of the EAU, EAW, I'm sorry. Too many three-letter acronyms, too many TLAs.
At that point, MPCA would have to make some kind of decision about what kind of assessment of water resources available for appropriation would be needed in the EAW. In this case, like I said, it was in progress. It was what DNR said it needed. And DNR, really importantly, DNR never here said that an aquifer test did not need to be in the EAW. In fact, it's pretty clear that that DNR wanted more information about the water resources in the EAW. There's a National Heritage Review letter from DNR that specifically says there needs to be enough information in the EAW to determine what the effects of the calcareous fens are. And then when DNR commented on the EAW, it specifically said, we don't have enough information here to fully comment on the effects of this well. It said that in its comment. So it's pretty clear that DNR wanted more information in the EAW that it didn't get.
But the fact of the matter is DNR was going to, and in fact, didn't get that information because DNR, in fact, took on, because there needed to be a permit, took on the additional analysis that now you're saying should have been done as part of an EAW. Again, I go back to Subdivision 15. That seems like a duplication of efforts to me. And I think it points to your other question raised in this case. And what is an assessment? What does that mean? And what is the level of fact gathering? I look at MEPA and I see the environmental assessment worksheet as a brief document designed to set out basic facts. Then you go down to subdivision 2A where it talks about the more robust environmental impact statement, and the word analyzes appears repeatedly. It seems to me that you're asking us to apply the same rigor to an assessment for EAW purposes that you would for environmental review under an EIS. Am I getting you wrong?
Your Honor, I don't think that's the case. There's so many things that I could say in response to that. With respect to the duplication, it's not a duplication. It's still DNR doing this test. All that MPCA would have to do is wait a little while, 2 months until the aquifer test comes out. And then it can be included in the EAW or be included in environmental review where it's supposed to be. And we can make decisions based on full information about what that feedlot cesium is going to be. With respect to what fact gathering needs to be in the EAW, Subdivision 16 is a really unique provision. Generally, the legislature left the form and content of the EAW up to the Environmental Quality Board, the agency that's entrusted with environmental review. But the legislature says specifically, and this is the only thing the legislature says, you have to have an EAW. And that is this assessment of the water resources available for appropriation. So it's a special requirement. And that's something that's really important to have before you're making decisions about whether environmental review can be completed.
So can I just, if the MPCA, because they were up against a deadline and Bear Family Farms could have agreed to the extension, but they refused. So under the rules, the MPCA had the choice of requiring an EIS or, a negative declaration. So if they had required an EIS and narrowed it to the aquifer test and the results of that test, would that have satisfied, would they have done what they were required to under the law then at that point in time?
Your Honor, if they had done that, we probably wouldn't be here right now, but that still would not have fixed the violation of Subdivision 16, which says that information has to be in the EAW.
So what more are you arguing does Subdivision 16 require?
It requires that you have an environmental assessment worksheet. That first document has to have this information in it. But as a practical matter, if MPCA had ordered that EIS, we wouldn't be here right now. We would have taken that and run with it.
I'm still struggling with the idea that Subdivision 16, there's no language with respect to the aquifer test. And the legislature has used that language in other parts and in other statutes, but it's notably absent here. And I also note that the EQB explicitly says that that those types of tests should be included in the EAW only if the DNR requires that. And I don't see any language from the DNR letters explicitly saying that those should be included. They only say that they're waiting on that information. That's very different than saying, we want this in the EAW.
Your Honor, so the EQB guidelines do say, they reference Subdivision 16. They say you need to focus on the ability of the water source to supply needed water drawdown and the effects to surface water features that are dependent on groundwater. And here DNR said, in order to know what the effects are on the drawdown, the effects on groundwater dependent features like calcareous fens, we need to have this aquifer test. So it's DNR saying, we've got to have the aquifer test. We don't know otherwise what the effects are going to be.
But it's the DNR saying that the DNR needs it. They didn't. They never explicitly came out and said, it's that we want this in order to be included in the EAW.
But the Heritage Review Letter does say that, Your Honor. It doesn't say the words aquifer test, but it says you need to have enough information to know what the effects are going to be on the calcareous fens. And in another place, it says, to know what the effects on the calcareous fens are, we need this aquifer test. So if you join those two things together, they're both from DNR, and they indicate that you do need to have the aquifer test. I see my time has elapsed. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Now we'll turn to counsel for respondent. I believe, Mr. Perry, you're going to proceed first. All right, you may do so. You are on mute. Looks good. Happens all the time.
Is it good now?
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. My apologies. Thanks. Thank God I have my IT guy here to hold my hand. May it please the court, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm here on behalf of respondent Barrick Family Farms. And I'd like to begin my comment with the Chief Judge Siegel's initial comment about what happens if you agree with the relator in this case and this is remanded back. And that is probably the most angst-producing question you could possibly ask, because we are in the situation that this court was faced in 2014 in the In re Gourley case, G-O-U-R-L-E-Y, where the approvals were in place and the pigs, two counties down in Todd County, were in the barn. And DNR, in that case, was found to have messed up by not making findings of fact. This court recognized the situation, and instead of reversing the DNR's water appropriation permit, they remanded back for appropriate findings so that literally the swine would not have to have been euthanized, because that's the alternative. In this case, we have a facility three times larger, as Ms. Anderson suggested or represented, and the swine have been ordered, long since ordered. There's a year-long process for all this to work. They will be in the barn before your ruling comes out. And my plea to you is that if you agree with the relator that you, at a minimum, remand so this process can go through, so we do not have to have the catastrophic euthanizing of 3,000 some animal units of swine. As to the merits of this case, I believe there are only two fact issues, and neither one I believe is disputed, and there are two very, very narrow legal issues. And as a spoiler alert, this court's Monday's decision, if I'm not sure if everyone's aware of this, I assume the chief judge knows all the decisions going on, but the Nolte case came out, and that was issued by Judge Smith and with the panel of Judge Connolly and Ross, and they addressed the same issue you have before it. And they came out our way, which is why I'm talking about it and relator is not. But as to the first point, the two facts are, as Judge Ray has pointed out, the EAW guidelines, which came out just 2 months after the sub 16 was enacted, the EQB directed, should and suggested the proposer and the RGU to contact the DNR to determine, and they use the word determine, whether the DNR required additional groundwater assessment beyond the standard preliminary well construction assessment, i.e. an aquifer test, would be done as part of the permitting process under the DNR or part of the environmental review. No one disputes that. That's on page 2728 of the 2013 EAW guidelines. The other undisputed fact is that on July 14th, 2020, DNR emailed both the proposer and the RGU, MPCA, and determined, quote, DNR will be requiring aquifer tests for application, our application. In other words, the aquifer test was going to be performed as part of the permitting process, not part of the environmental review process.
Mr. Perry, let me stop you there. Ms. Anderson asserts that in terms of other types of review and other issues, you may be right that the fact that another entity is going to be going through a permitting process might take that outside of the scope of the, or may obviate the need for an EIS on that issue. But Subdivision 16 carves out an exception for groundwater appropriation, which is the point here. And it strikes me that there is merit to Ms. Anderson's argument that there really was no robust assessment in the EAW of the groundwater appropriation issue, and that you can't, based on Subdivision 16, defer that to another entity such as the DNR. Why is she wrong in that assertion?
She's wrong. First of all, factually, you are correct, and we have it all over our papers. The DNR concluded way back on July 14th, the same letter, that the preliminary well construction assessment was inadequate, their words, no question about it. So the question is, and this is the issue that was addressed in the October 2013 EAW guidelines by the EQB, because the EQB is the entity upon which this requirement is imposed. But the EQB is not an RGU, so they needed to give direction to all the RGUs as to how does this work. And so that's why they said, Judge Berkman, they recognized that we have a dilemma here. We have the water appropriation requirements, where it's all DNR, and then we have the RGU, the MEPA requirements. How do you reconcile that? And how do you reconcile it with Subdivision 15, which prohibits duplication, with Minnesota Rule 0300 subpart 4E, which it's one of five objectives to eliminate duplication, or 116D04 subdivision 2A, that again prohibits duplication and also requires that the agencies ensure coordination between, in their language, the environmental review and environmental permitting. All this has to be coordinated, and there is not a bright line, which is why the EQB said critically in October 2013, you need to go to the DNR and ask them, which is what we did. And the DNR came back and said, we're going to do it as part of the permitting process. No question about that. And it's critically important, too, is that the EQB under 116C04 subdivision 2C, EQB, they break the ties between governmental entities. Who decides whether it's the RGU as part of the environmental review or the DNR as part of its job, who does what? And EQB breaks ties. They resolve conflicts between the nine agencies underneath them with regard to environmental decisions.
So, Mr. Perry, but didn't the legislature, you said, how do you coordinate between the DNR and their activities and the EAW? Didn't the legislature, though, dictate, as Judge Bjorkman was saying, by saying it has to be part of the EAW, analysis?
Yeah, so what they said was...
So doesn't that more specific provision take precedence over Subdivision 15, which is a more general provision about duplication? And why is that wrong?
The words in the statute are critically important. They are reinforced by the author of the legislation and by the DNR. We had to fight about what you get to look at for the legislative history, but in the transcript and in the House research, all they interpreted sub 16 to require is to identify the water available for appropriation. And in the transcript, all DNR said is it requires the applicant and the RGU to, quote, look at the water available for appropriation. That's what they interpreted. And the language of the statute, if I can finish, I know my time's up.
I'll let you conclude that thought.
Thank you. Is the statute says an assessment of water availability for appropriation, which is the almost identical language under the DNR's requirements. I think my time's up. Thank you very much.
Judge Reyes, I believe you have a question. You can
yes, proceed. If I may ask one more question. Mr. Perry, I note in your brief at the very end that you state that you recommend that this should be a precedential opinion, and certainly appreciate you highlighting that. My question to you is, what would be the syllabus points that you would recommend that this should be precedential on?
I said that, and according to Monday's Nolte decision, which involved this same argument, sub 16 argument, if you look at page 32 of the DNR's brief in that case, same issue, sub 16 argument. And in that case, the court disagreed with my conclusion at the end and said it's a non-precedential issue. And the reason they said that, I believe, and I think you and Judge Borkman issued a Westcott decision a few years ago that did the same thing, is they didn't analyze it under the issues we're talking about. They analyzed it under the standard substantial evidence standard, which is, I think, the right standard under an EIS challenge. And so they didn't have to get into the issues we were talking about in this case at all, because they just applied the old precedent effectively to reject the arguments that were made. That makes sense?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Now we will hear from counsel for respondent, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. O'Donovan, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Colin O'Donovan, and I represent the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. This court should affirm the MPCA's negative declaration need for an EIS impact statement for two reasons. First, an aquifer test is not required to be included in an EAW, and Minnesota Statute 116D04 Subdivision 6 at most only requires a preliminary well construction assessment. That determination is supported by the plain language, the legislative history, and EQB guidance. Second, the MPCA's determination that the project does not have the potential for significant environmental effects was based on substantial evidence and is entitled to deference. In arriving at that determination, the MPCA analyzed the four required factors, which are the type of impacts, cumulative impacts, mitigation, and extent the effects anticipated can be controlled with additional studies. All four factors heavily weighed in favor of a negative declaration, including in particular the ongoing regulatory authority of the DNR in the form of statutes and rules that prohibit the harm that they have raised here, specifically related to calcareous fens and to well interferences. Regarding the first issue, there is nothing in the plain language of the statute that requires an aquifer test. It requires an assessment of a water resources available for appropriation. Your Honor, when you asked, does it require a robust assessment? That question about robust is a qualitative inclusion that is not in the statute. It's also not required under the EQB guidance. The EQB guidance in our addendum on page 9 specifically identifies that there is a distinction between major appropriations, which are over $100 million per year, and minor appropriations like this one. It's approximately one-tenth of a major appropriation. So none of the danger signals that you would be concerned about with an extremely large dairy, for example, are present here.
But Mr. O'Donovan, if I could stop you for a moment. I mean, my problem here is that, you know, I appreciate what Relator is arguing. That is, we were so close. DNR was so close to being done with its evaluation. I mean, it strikes me that it was arbitrary. Why didn't MPCA wait for another month or two so that everything could be resolved at one time? I mean, why isn't that an arbitrary decision to plow forward knowing that necessary information is at hand?
Yeah, it goes to your initial question of what were they required to do when they denied when Mr. Perry's client denied its extension and said, we will not agree. That required the MPCA to make the determination of whether this aquifer test was required. That's its statutory obligation, and it did so here. And what it looked at and said is, this information is being compiled. It's being compiled as part of a permitting analysis, which is not supposed to be required and not supposed to be duplicated. We have all the record here, which is related to a preliminary well construction assessment. DNR from the get-go has been on top of this issue saying, we're going to require more, we're going to be looking at this. And in its official comment letter, which is all under the law that the MPCA is actually required to analyze under the National Audubon case, it specifically said, we are handling this in the permitting analysis. The DNR knows how to write a comment letter that says, we want to see this in an EAW. In the Troutman case cited by the MCEA, three different agencies came out and said, to the Department of Agriculture, do not do what you're doing. More analysis needs to be done. So the DNR knows how to write that letter, and it did not write that letter here. The letter that it wrote was, we are analyzing this. We understand what the issues are, and we are going to require additional analysis. And that analysis occurred in July after the MPCA had already initiated its EAW process. When it was required to look at the issue because it was forced to, it followed its statutory obligation and determined it was not necessary to look at this anymore. To Judge Siegel's point.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. O'Donovan, you said at the beginning of your statement there, you said that the question is that the MPCA had answers whether an aquifer test is required. Isn't the answer to that question yes in this case? And if the answer to that is yes, then why didn't it wait to get that aquifer test back from the DNR?
Because the answer is no. And that's conclusively proven by exactly what we've already identified. The EQB guidance states that when it's required.
Hold on 1 second, though. Hold, if I could just interrupt. I mean, paragraph 48 of the findings of the MPCA and their determination is that the project as proposed does not have the potential for significant environmental effects. But it in fact did. The DNR said there is the potential here. We need this added aquifer test. So I would say an aquifer test was in fact required at that point. And so wouldn't it have been the best practice to say, yes, you know, Barrick Family Farms, and if they've got, you know, hogs in the barn, if, you know, they could have agreed to the delay for another 30 days or however long, but they didn't. So should the MPCA have said, yes, this is additional information we need. We are going to require a very narrow EIS, and, you know, scope just to the DNR's processes. I mean, why is that not a preferred way of proceeding?
Because the statutory requirement is whether it's necessary. And the standard on an EIS under Minnesota Rule 4410-1700 is whether there is reasonably expected to be harm from these effects. There is not reasonably likely to be harm to the fens or to the well interferences because they are prohibited by law. There is a calcareous fen statute that says you may not harm these. And DNR in its official comment letter has acknowledged that. DNR from the very beginning has acknowledged and told them in the preliminary well construction assessment, you can't go to the east, well, that area is off limits. You're going to be downgrading. You know, that's an area where there is the ability to appropriate. We have to just identify the location. And that's exactly what they did. And so the question here is whether they were required to look at this and whether it was necessary. And when you have a statute on point that it deals with the harms that they're concerned about, the answer is no, that information is not necessary, especially when it will be considered as part of a permitting process and the permitting entity has acknowledged that. And that's true also, they didn't raise this in their comment letter. In fact, no private well owner has, but as to the well interferences, it's also the same is true. They have a priority under the statute. Domestic users have the highest priority, including over dairy, dairies, swine farms, all other industrial users, and they're prohibited from pumping until any conflicts are resolved. So here it's not necessary to go any further because we know under the statute and under the rules that there can be no harm. I see that my time is up if there's any further questions.
Anything further from the panel? I see no further questions. Oh, I guess we have one more. Go ahead, Judge Reyes. Yeah,
I just want to follow up with Chief Judge Siegel's comment there. Didn't the DNR say that this could impact the calcareous fens?
It said that there is the potential to do so and that it may. And what they are doing is analyzing okay. that. And the standard, though, however, is not, is it possible? And that goes to the decision that Mr. Perry was referencing earlier panel that you were on, which is whether or not it is reasonably likely to occur. And that's the analysis under mitigation. And under mitigation, it's not just simply, is it possible? Is there the potential? But is it reasonably expected to occur? And in the decision that he referenced, the Westcott decision.
But going back to Chief Judge Siegel's point on finding of fact 48, it says NPCA finds it does not have the potential. And if that's, but if the DNR said it does have the potential, isn't that finding of fact erroneous?
No, because the standard is whether there is reasonably expected to occur.
I understand what the standard is.
The point being, whether the DNR would be likely to appropriate an amount of water that could harm the fen, that is the question that has to be answered. And the question that is, does the MPCA need this aquifer test to determine whether that is reasonably likely to occur, given that it is in violation of Minnesota law, and specifically a calcareous fen statute that says no one, including the DNR, may impact this fen? And the answer to that question is, no, it's not erroneous, because that can't happen.
I'm sorry, Judge, I was
just going to say it can, but the standard you're citing is not the standard that the MPC cited in finding fact 48. It cited to the potential, which echoes what the DNR and is contrary to what the DNR said. So, sorry, go ahead, Chief.
I think I've forgotten my question now.
Mr. Reyes, to your point, they said that in 48, they specifically said that are reasonably expected to occur. That's the language that was omitted prior, and that's exactly the standard under mitigation and under that requirement. And so that was analyzed by the MPCA, that was analyzed correctly under the required rule, which is Minnesota Rule 4410-1700, Subdivision 6. And that is the standard by which
Could I ask one quick question, Judge Bjorkman, or not?
You may ask one question.
Okay. So with calcareous fens, hopefully I'm saying that correctly, because of the clear statutory protection, if a water appropriation is required such that there is going to be a DNR permitting process, can EAWs then just ignore that whole process and always just say, the DNR will take care of it? I mean, does it?
No.
Why not?
The short answer is no, because under the statute, the assessment that's required is a preliminary well construction assessment. Specifically in 103G287, that is identified, the exact same word that was created by the exact same author in the exact same bill that created subdivision 16 that we're all talking about, also created this exact same provision. And it specifically identified, quote, an assessment that the DNR must make. And it relates to an aquifer, the formation of the aquifer, the pumping. That is the assessment and the type of assessment that's required. And as Mr. Perry identified, the legislative history that your honors will have to decide, the DNR specifically identified and called out, this is the information that we have solved the sustainability problem. They were concerned about a large ethanol plant with Representative Lagunias. And the DNR's statement on the record was, the way to solve that problem is to require a preliminary well construction assessment. And that is what they did here. And that's what they would always have to do, to your point, Judge Siegel. They can't just ignore and say, we don't have to do anything because there's some statute or some standard. That's not the case. It still requires the analysis that's under that statute, which is the preliminary well construction assessment.
Thank you, counsel. If I see no more questions, I think your time has expired and then some. Ms. Anderson, we will then turn to you. You have the final word on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points about the Nolte case that Mr. Perry mentioned, about the plain language of Subdivision 16, and then about what happens if we rely on the statute prohibiting harm to calcareous fens to actually as the only mitigation here. So first of all, with respect to the Nolte case, that case is very different from this case. They don't talk, the order doesn't talk anywhere about Subdivision 16. So we don't have, as Mr. Perry said, any of the issues that we're talking about here with respect to Subdivision 16. And in addition, in Nolte, the aquifer test was finished and was available at the time that the EIS decision was made. And so there was the aquifer test, they could look at it, and they included actual restrictions about what the water pumping was going to do that the court said would prevent interference with domestic wells. So it's a completely different situation. Point two, so according to Mr. Donovan, you have to give deference to MPCA's reading of Subdivision 16. But if you look at the language of that statute, that is not a technical statute. There's not language that you need MPCA's technical expertise to interpret. We're talking available, we're talking assessment. These are very easy words. And so this court should look at the plain language meaning of those words. And let's look at a couple of key phrases in the statute. First of all, assessment of the water resources. The parties bickered in their briefs a bit about what assessment means, but if you look at any definition, it involves some kind of evaluation of facts and reaching some kind of determination. And then if you look at available for appropriation, what does that mean? It has to mean not only that there's water there, but that that water can be taken and used by the feedlot, that it's available for appropriation, taking it, using it. And under Minnesota law, there are limits on what water a feedlot like Barracks can take and appropriate. You can't, as we've been talking about, harm calcareous fens. You can't interfere with domestic wells. You can't have an appropriation that's unsustainable. In those cases, water is legally not available for appropriation. So to comply with Subdivision 16, the EAW needs to look at whether there's sufficient water there for Barrick to take this 15 million gallons and use it without running afoul of these legal limitations.
Again, I'm troubled by the word assessment as opposed to ultimately determine, because I'm looking at the EAW and I see several pages of discussion about water appropriation and the potential impact on the calcareous fens and the depth of the groundwater and the fact that you're going to have DNR involvement in doing testing. I mean, why isn't that language? And I guess I'm looking specifically at pages 33 through 35 of the EA your addendum and saying, why isn't that an assessment for purposes of Subdivision 16?
Your Honor, it doesn't look at facts and evaluate them because there aren't facts yet to evaluate. The facts are coming with the aquifer test. The aquifer test is going to say, can you take this water? Is there enough there? Will it affect the calcareous fens? Will it affect the wells? We don't have the facts yet, and you can't assess what you don't have. So that is my point here, is that there's simply no information in the EAW where they say, yes, Bear can take this water, and it will have enough, and it won't run afoul of these legal limits. And I think that's really important. For my third point, I just want to play out. Yes, Judge Reyes.
Yeah, but isn't it important to also respect the lines of demarcation in terms of responsibility between the various agencies? I think that's one of the things that I'm having a hard time getting over, is that the PCA has an obligation to do this preliminary assessment, which is a very limited assessment. But you've got the DNR that's responsible for the aquifer test, doing it and enforcing those rules. Isn't this really an issue of just the MPCA respecting those lines that have been drawn between the various agencies and allowing the DNR to do what it is responsible for?
Your Honor, MPCA, as the person or as the agency in charge of the environmental assessment or the environmental review in total, it has its own obligations and it has to comply with those. And it has to look at every single potential significant environmental effect. And that's what it has to do. It has to gather that information from all around. The fact that DNR is gathering this information doesn't mean that MPCA doesn't have the responsibility to take it and use it in the aquifer, in its environmental review. And again, it's not that the aquifer test every single time would have to be this assessment of the water resources available for appropriation. In this case, it's the most reasonable one. But if MPCA did have some other way to assess, is there sufficient water there? Can Barrick take these 15 million gallons? It could do that. Here, it didn't do that. You don't have to decide whether the aquifer test needed to be in the EAW. You need to decide whether there was any assessment of the water resources available for appropriation in the EAW, and there simply is not. And I'm sorry, I went over my time. I will wrap up unless there's any more questions.
Can I ask
Judge Siegel, do you have a question? Yes, please.
Yes, I do. And hopefully it's a quick one. Is this case somewhat unique in the sense that there is a very, very specific statute protecting calcareous fens? And so, you know, can we just rely on the language in the Card case of the Minnesota Supreme Court and say, here we've got this very, very specific protection. The DNR has clear responsibilities here. And so we're satisfied. I mean, that's in essence what the MPCA did. And so as opposed to other situations, and maybe this doesn't help out with domestic wells, I suppose, but does that distinguish this particular case?
Your Honor, that's exactly the third point that I wanted to talk about. So I'm so glad you asked. Yes, it's important that there's this calcareous fen statute here. And that's part of why we are so concerned about this, right? Like, we want to make sure the calcareous fens are protected as they're supposed to be. But let's play out what happens if, for a mitigation, instead of having what CARD requires, specific, targeted, certain to prevent the environmental harms, you simply say, there's a statute, everything's fine, we don't need to worry about it. So simply having the statute, first of all, someone has to determine that the statute has been violated. So we've got Barrick pumping the well, right? Maybe it's affecting the calcareous fens. No one goes out there. No one finds it out. Barrick's not looking. DNR goes out there occasionally. So maybe they find that there's effects to the calcareous fens. They find that. They talk to Barrick. They're not going to shut off the water to 16,000 hogs. They say, let's try to find a way to make this work. Maybe we'll try this thing. Maybe we'll try that thing. Mitigation measures that should have been in place already. At this point, the damage to the calcareous fens is probably already done. Calcareous fens are extremely dependent on groundwater. They're super fragile. Once you cut off that groundwater, invasive plants come in and you can't get that calcareous fen back. So it's simply not enough to say we can stop this after it happens, after there's already harm to the calcareous fens because of the statute. What CARD requires is that you have effects, you have mitigations that are certain to prevent the harm from happening. And the statute's simply not going to do that.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. I believe the panel has no additional questions, so we will take the matter under advisement. Thank you all for your helpful argument and briefing in this case. We will issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Your Honor.